This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
It's fair to say that thrifting queen, professional photographer and poo practitioner is not your average collection of job titles, but there is nothing ordinary about today's guest. Anna Easton is here to spill the tea on all aspects of her eclectic and varied life, from thrift mania to stunning photography and a foray into the business of effluence and everything else in between. Welcome to Tell Me Moya, where the chats are candid, the laughs are loud, and nothing is off limits. I'm Harriet Moya, and each episode I'm sitting down with brilliant women or people who identify as women for no filter and no nonsense chats about, well, pretty much anything. Real, relatable, and at times raucous, Tell Me Moya dives right into the conversations we want to have but don't have time for, and the ones we don't want to have but we know we should. Strap in. Are you ready for Tell Me Moya? So I want to introduce you properly, though, and let everyone know that season one of Tell Me Moya kicks off quite simply with a collection of conversations with eight interesting women I know. And our guest today takes interesting to the next level. Anna Easton's life is a collection of first-hand adventures and carefully curated second-hand treasures. Her website, online community and blog, She Hunts Op Shops, boasts over 25,000 followers, proving that her words and images are just as collectible as her thrifted finds. So welcome, Anna, to Tell Me Moya. I am very delighted to have you here with me today. So when I say have you here, you're actually in Christchurch and we are Zooming. So to see your beautiful face on the screen. And I am somewhat relieved that it is just your face and torso, because just before the interview you said to me that you were vacuuming in your undies.
It's actually nice to not be wearing pants.
Oh, great. Look, I'm really happy for you, and I'm glad that you feel relaxed enough to be pantless for this interview.
The only person who has a problem with it is my daughter. She's constantly telling me to put them on these days.
Oh, yeah. It's funny they switch.
Oh, Mum.
They're so okay with all the nudity for so long, and then they immediately, it's like something happens overnight, and they're like, oh, my God, disgusting. Pants on. Yeah. I know my girls are absolutely reviled if I so much as put my head through the door if I'm just wearing undies or something. They're just like, oh, my God, gross. That's so disgusting. It's like I need to remind them from whence they came from, you know, like the vajayjay.
Yes. Actually, I should use that one. I didn't think to go that far, but maybe I will.
Yeah, it's like, well, I mean, you've really been right in there, so... this is actually relatively showing a relative amount of decorum, all things considered. So it's really exciting to have you here in studio today. I'm absolutely delighted. You are a woman that absolutely fascinates me. I feel that I relate to you in lots of ways in terms of being sort of a multi-passionate creative, so we have that in common and we can explore all of that. But to kick off the interview, this is something that I'm just trying with all the women that I'm interviewing this season, just to see if it's an interesting kind of way to start our conversation. I just wanted to ask you, Anna, if you think that woman can have it all.
Can women have it all? I mean, honestly, no. I mean, I think we've been sold this idea. I think we've been sold this idea that we can have it all, like all at once and all perfectly, and it's just not real. I mean, you can have a lot, but something's usually on fire in the background.
Totally.
I mean, you could be walking down the hallway at the end of what feels like the best day of your life, thinking to yourself smugly, oh, man, I've such a good day, and then your child could walk out of their room and vomit on your feet.
Yes, of course.
So, no, I don't think we get to have it all. Definitely not in the way that it's sold to us.
No, and I do think life just ebbs and flows, doesn't it? It's like there are times where we are all really able to focus on our careers and everything falls into place and that's really amazing. But, you know, show me a woman who is working really hard on her career, who doesn't kind of walk around carrying some kind of guilt that she's not being there enough for her family, or, you know, the woman who's totally devoted to her family, but there's that tiny part of herself that's really wishing she had more time for her career, vice versa, whatever. Or, you know, yeah, you've got young children. It's really hard to find the time to focus on your health and all of those things. I think it's, as you say, you can have quite a few of the things, but pretty much.
Put some things on fire in the background, and that's okay.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Watch them burn. Yeah. Or maybe lots of little fires, yeah. Now, so in the relatively short time that I have known you or known of you, I am aware that in that time you've lived in Oamaru, Dunedin, and now you're living in Christchurch. And I also know that you did a stint, like a decent stint, 10 years in Melbourne prior to all of that. So, is it fair to say that you are quite intrepid by nature? Like, has this all been of your own kind of choosing and you are naturally someone who's migratory, I think that's a word, or is this, are these things where your hand has been forced, you know, like, or is it a bit of both? Like, what's the scoop?
Gosh, no. I mean, it's strange because I had quite a, you know, a country idyllic childhood, and you'd call it sheltered. I was shy, and I look back at photos of myself when I was a little girl, and I just think, gosh, you know, she was just so small. But I moved out of home when I was 16, because I just knew that I needed bigger, grander things. I was living in Oamaru at the time with my family, and I moved to Dunedin. Because I needed more. I needed more music. I needed more stimulation. I needed more creativity in my life.
And it just wasn't. Some people might find that hilarious that the big smoke was Dunedin. But compared with Oamaru, I guess.
I mean, it was far better than being in Oamaru, for sure.
Yeah.
I moved to Dunedin when I was 16. And then from there, I stayed in Dunedin for a couple of years, and it just still, again, wasn't enough. So I was flicking through a newspaper one evening. I was about 17 years old, and there was an ad in the back of it, and all it said was, "Nanny wanted, Detroit, Michigan," and the phone number. So I thought, I'm gonna call that.
Oh, of course. I mean, why wouldn't you?
Exactly. So I scraped together some change, and I went to the payphone and I phoned Detroit. And I spoke to a woman, and I got a job as a nanny for
just
a family.
That conversation. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was like, you'll do.
Pretty much. She was looking for, so these ladies in Detroit, they specifically targeted the ODT in Dunedin because they wanted a country Kiwi girl.
Oh, they had the jackpot. You know,
and that was me. So I did. I flew to Detroit on my own at the tender age of 18.
Amazing.
And I lived there for a year. At the time, it was the murder capital of America, and it was so much fun. It was so much fun. Oh, my goodness.
So you weren't, it wasn't one of those situations where you were kind of trapped in the nannying au pair vibe?
Well, I was.
Kind
of like, I don't really talk too much about that part of it, but yes, it was very much that, Harriet. Was living in the basement of their home, and I worked, you know, 7 days a week from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day. But I made use of my weekends, and at the time, I just would go and see weekend, massive tax,
tequila.
Nice. Just every weekend I was out seeing music.
Just on your own, or did you meet friends, or were there other like other nannies around? Or
initially it was me on my own, and I was quite lonely, so I was sending faxes back to my friend in Dunedin, because at the time there was no internet. And I managed to convince my very good friend Esther, who I lived with in Dunedin at the time when I left to go to Detroit. I kept sending her all these faxes, like, "Oh my gosh, this band's playing tonight, and oh, you've got to come, I can get you a job. I promise I can get you a job." And she flew over and I got her a job. So we both hung out there together.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah, get your bestie over.
Yeah, I mean,
who can be bothered making new friends? Just reach out to your bestie. They're always there for you. That's amazing. That's
awesome. And we're still really cute friends now too, even all these years later. So that kickstarted my traveling. I backpacked and traveled intrepidly around the world for 20 years.
Yeah. So you are very
including
intrepid.
Detroit. Yeah, I would literally just arrive in a country with maybe, I don't know, $50 and a backpack. And you could find work immediately anywhere you went if you were that way inclined. And these are the days before, you know, 9/11 and COVID,
yeah,
where you
sure.
could just kind of slip through borders and travel quite easily.
Amazing.
And that's where I met my husband as well. We met in London in a granny.
Is he a Kiwi or is he English?
He is South African.
Right. Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I actually moved into the flat that he was living in and got the bunk bed above his. and I fell in love with him the second I saw him.
Aww.
And we've been together for 20 years.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Did he fall in love with you the second he saw you?
I think so. I think he was – I know that I am when people meet me – they like Sean would probably describe to you me being like a real life Care Bear preview. I'm like a Care Bear that's constantly like loving out of my eyes and my heart, and
oh,
everything is
yes,
beautiful.
That's a beautiful way
so
to describe
sweet.
You. Yeah.
It's like a constant Care Bear preview with like glitter coming out of my heart. I'm like, it's a bit much sometimes.
There are worse ways.
My eternal happiness is yeah, it can be intense.
It's endearing and
even
charming
for me.
And fabulous. So he might have found you a bit full on at first.
yeah, a bit full on. Because he's not the same as me. He's
right.
The opposite. He's very intelligent and you know, he thinks about things way too much, whereas I'm just like, let's go.
Yeah, right.
Let's go to South America.
Totally.
Yes.
Impulsive.
Go to
and
Jamaica.
From the heart. Yeah. Amazing.
Buy that house.
Well, they say the opposites attract, so there we go. It's a match made in heaven.
Yeah.
We've got so much to talk about. We need to move on. I can tell this is going to be one of those days where we will have to have you back. Anyway, so the thing is, though, you were in Melbourne and then you moved to Oamaru of all the places, right? So
we moved back to Oamaru.
I know.
Yes.
So this is wild because obviously I've read that you had your own beautiful home that you had built in Melbourne and your photography business was thriving and your partners had good work. You had Frankie. Life was good. So what on earth compelled you to think, oh, my God, let's go to Oamaru, go back to Oamaru?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, COVID was a huge driving force behind the decision to move back to Oamaru.
Right.
We'd lived in Melbourne for a decade, and yes, I'd started my business from scratch with no experience, which was awesome, and it was thriving, but COVID just sort of, you know, everything died that day. I cancelled all my weddings. I cancelled about, I don't know, 15 weddings in 2 days. Sean's job just, I mean, you know, he just couldn't go to work because he was working in hospitality at the time. And
right.
So everything really just came to a standstill. And so we'd often thought about moving back to New Zealand because I'm from Oamaru and we didn't have any family in Melbourne. And we'd been looking at businesses in Oamaru. Nothing really jumped out at us until one day a septic tank and portaloo business was
for
sale.
I
know, of all
the
things.
Thing. This is
what we've been looking at other businesses, like a little photography store, maybe a cafe or something. But I mean, when you've worked in hospitality for decades like we have, you kind of get punched in the face every single day. And we knew that we didn't want to own a cafe.
Yep, 100%.
And I knew I didn't want to own a little photo store selling, you know, film and photo frames. And so the sewage business, it just seemed like a really good idea because it was an essential service. It would never end. It was going to be something that people always needed.
But did you feel like, did you look at it and go, oh, yeah, we are so qualified to do this? Or like look at it and think, what made you think like, yeah, this is a really, really good fit? I mean, I know you were saying there are all those really good reasons why in terms of essential services, et cetera. But like it just seems like mind blowing that you would be like, yeah, no, I can see myself in poo. I can see myself in poo. Yeah.
Fuck no, no. I mean, I didn't even know what a septic tank was.
Right.
But I trusted everybody around me. Sean had studied for 3 years at RMIT. He did sustainability and politics. And I knew that whatever Sean and I did together, that we would just be able to succeed no matter what.
Awesome. How great. We
were up for the challenge. We definitely weren't under any illusions that it was going to be easy or that we were going to have things handed to us on a silver platter. By George, we did not.
Yeah. But, I mean, people were handing shit to you on a platter. That's not really.
Yeah. We knew that we would be able to do it. We never foresaw what would happen to us once we arrived in Oamaru, which was, I don't know, an anomaly or a blip in time.
Yes, let's talk about that a little bit because so now you're owning this Portaloo and Effluent Services business. Okay, great, amazing. And
I know how to spell effluent now.
That's great. And the difference between effluent and effluence, can you tell me?
Well, isn't it affluent? Effluent and affluent isn't affluent.
Yes, is effluence just not a word? Effluence, it's just effluent.
No, effluence is not a word.
Okay, I made that up then. Earlier.
You did make that up.
That's great. My show, I can make stuff up. It's fine.
You totally can.
I can do whatever
you
I like.
You have me believing it too.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So now there is a word called effluence. So you've got this business and how long, because from what I understand, things did turn a little bit nasty. Now, obviously, when you are running a poo business, it's sort of nasty by nature. But
I mean, take it from me. Just don't move to a rural town and buy a sewage business.
Okay, hot tip for the listeners. Just if that was on your dance card for 2026, just don't do it. Just don't do it. Tell us, I mean, how long before the proverbial shit hit the fan?
I mean, honestly, we moved to Oamaru thinking that we were going to be starting this wholesome new chapter. Like, we were a young family. It was a new business. We were so excited. We bounced into it with so much optimism and love, as we do with everything. We were looking forward to a slower pace of life. And, you know, we just knew that Oamaru was a genuinely stunning place. It was just emotionally complex, like a scenic relationship that you probably should have left a lot earlier. Within a pretty short amount of time, it turned into what felt like a lifestyle, like what felt like less of a lifestyle change and more of a psychological thriller. It was one of those situations where it's like, is this real life or am I living in some kind of weird reality show like The Twilight Zone? Nutshell, without going into too much detail, we ended up in a really intense situation with a small group of people who just hated us.
Right.
It went on for years. And no matter what we did to create space, whether it was moving house or moving our business to try and avoid it, it just seemed to escalate instead of settle down. And because of the nature of it, it was really hard to pin down or prove. And I just felt like I was going insane, and so did Sean.
Oh, my gosh, that sounds terrible.
All this place, and we were stuck in this sewage business that was drowning us. But, I mean, if I didn't laugh about it, I'd probably still be stuck in a paddock somewhere screaming into the
Well, so, you can laugh about it now, though, but, like, it hasn't been any laughing matter. I know that it's been really, really traumatic and difficult for you, and meant that you made
awful.
A move to Dunedin.
Years.
Yeah, it's any
yeah, so
kind
we,
of
we managed to escape.
Oh, sorry, we keep talking over each other. Any sort of personal conflict like that with you know, it's one thing when a business is falling apart or something and it's sort of things that are out of your control and it's not people, but it's another thing when you're dealing with actual people that are making your life a living hell, and that can just be so hard to understand. Yeah. So hard to understand, and the truth becomes you know, there's different versions of the truth and it's all just, it's so yuck. So you do have my deepest, deepest sympathy for everything that you have been through. But as you were about to say, it's that thing like, you know, you kind of have to laugh now and look back and laugh. And that's that whole like, comedy is tragedy plus time. That's the saying. Uh-huh. That's the way saying goes.
I honestly think that humour was what saved Sean and I through those darkest years. We were still able to laugh about everything that was happening to us while it was happening because, honestly, Harriet, it was so unbelievably unreal.
So ridiculous. Yeah.
It didn't make any sense. And it was funny to us because it was like, is this real? Is this really happening to us?
It's such a fascinating approach to that kind of thing because I can relate to this completely. Like, obviously, my job as a comedian and all of the traumas and things that I've had in my life, I've turned into bits on stage and stuff. Like, you can probably hear with my voice at the moment. It's not really, I've got a voice disorder and I've turned that into a whole big thing that I do on stage is partly as a way of just processing it for me. But you know, there are different types of people, aren't there? There are other people that can look at things and just laugh, and then there are other people who will really let the, you know, the for want of a better word, really let the meanies get them down. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to take a quick moment to hear from our sponsors, but when we come back, I'd love for you to read a tiny little excerpt from your book that you've written about this experience. Are you on board with that? Okay, let's just hear from our amazing sponsors.
Looking to make your next property move in Dunedin? Call the team that lives and breathes property. At NZ Property Solutions, we're 100% locally owned, packed with worldwide property experience, bold ideas, and serious property market know-how. We're passionate, connected, and yes, we love a good laugh too. Ready for a cracking result? Call the team at NZ Property Solutions today and let's get you moving. 0800 22 96 55.
Right, so as mentioned, we're going to dive in and Anna is going to share a little excerpt from a book that she's been writing about this whole Poonami explosion disaster and that they experienced in Oamaru. So you've got a little snippet there for us?
I do. The only way that I could kind of make sense of all of this was to write it down, and I frantically spent weeks writing it down so that it was still all fresh in my head. So I do have, this is chapter 16.
Great.
And I've named the book so far, I think it's called So You Want to Buy a Poo Business. And this chapter is called Someone Somewhere Has to Poo. So it's 3 pages. It should just go for 3 minutes, I think, if I read it nicely. Beautiful. Someone Somewhere Has to Poo. The first 6 months felt like we'd been blasted out of an old-time war cannon, tied together, stark naked, and shot into some bald, blistering wasteland. We hit the ground running, full pace, barefoot and confused, while what felt like an entire angry village came thundering after us with pitchforks. Those weeks between Christmas and the end of January 2020 were an absolute blur, all rolled into one long, chaotic, fever-filled dream. As if COVID wasn't enough, life decided to fling a few extra disasters our way. One weekend, in the middle of camping season, a horrific storm rolled through the valley, the biggest the Lakes District had seen in decades. It rained for days. The lakes swelled, the rivers burst out of the southern Alps like angry beasts, and flooding tore through the land. Campers were told to evacuate as the lake banks overflowed. Folks left their campsites in droves, but our portaloos stood strong. We kept cleaning them every day while living out of our caravan because shit stops for no one. At one point, our biggest client rang and a panicked staff member practically roared down the phone, "The ablution blocks at Fort Marina have flooded and we need 4 more portaloos there immediately." Sean was whipping around the lake in our trusty portaloo truck with zero phone reception, leaving me to sort this shit show of a problem out solo. I blindly swung into action, jumped in the ute and drove all the way back to town, hitched up a double portaloo unit on a trailer and towed it straight back to the lakes. That's customer service for you. Feral energy, questionable decisions, and a trailer full of doom. A tidy 200-kilometre round trip. And the catch was, I'd never towed anything in my life. Not a trailer, not a caravan, not even a renegade wheelie bin. I had watched Sean hitch trailers enough times that I had the gist. So on pure adrenaline, I flung the Portaloo trailer onto the ute, latched it up with the confidence of a woman who probably should not be trusted with machinery, and took off into the storm while the universe slow clapped in the background. One last bit. It was bucketing down. The roads were flooding. The window wipers could not keep up. As I drove into the actual eye of the storm with my Portaloo, a steady line of campers were fleeing in the opposite direction. I must have looked completely unhinged, driving the wrong way with my Portaloo swaying behind me. All I could do was scream over the steering wheel and into the sleeting rain repeatedly, almost crazy-like, someone somewhere has to poo. If the gods were watching, they absolutely pissed themselves laughing. As I crossed the last heavy bridge into the lakes area, I saw the raging river licking its way up over the edge. Police suddenly swarmed in behind me to close the bridge. I pulled over and watched, genuinely stunned, as the entire bridge was torn away by the furious river, carrying tree stumps and debris like a conveyor belt of doom. That was the moment the universe quietly whispered, "Oh, Pixie, you're not in the shallow end anymore. Shit's about to get real." Chapter 17. Meanwhile, back at the poo yard.
Oh, my goodness. So beautiful. Such a beautiful, such beautiful language and just hilarious. And that will just be one of.
I had to write it all down. Every day was like a Netflix television show about a Portaloo business.
And someone somewhere who has to shit. Yeah, has to poo. Exactly. So this is a book that you're writing. Yeah, and you needed to provide the toilets. This is insane. It's insane.
It was insane.
I see what you meant about it being an essential business as well. You know, sorry, what did you just say?
And then we also had to deal with the waste.
Oh, I don't think we have time to go there today. Gross. So I'm so impressed with both of your gumption and your like belief and your optimism in terms of thinking that you could do this thing. And I love that you just jumped in there and
took really well.
The business.
Yeah. We did. We've just sold. We sold it a few months ago.
Yay.
Yay.
Absolutely. What a relief.
We sold it spectacularly. We're really happy.
Great.
And now we're just concentrating on our mental health and trying to, break down what actually happened. And we're just putting our life back together. I know I sound really happy and buzzy, and I am. I genuinely am. But gosh, we were in a dark place. I mean, I was suicidal.
Goodness.
With a suspected heart attack. We lost everything.
It was a
nightmare.
Yeah, an absolute nightmare.
So
I would say it hasn't just completely destroyed you, because there's still this tiny little glow of hope and optimism that you have. Yeah.
The caregiver is coming back. Yes. Sean said that to me the other day, actually. He had a little tear in his eye, and he said, "I've missed your eternal optimism."
Aww.
As he cuddled. I know, it was great, because it disappeared for so many years.
Understandably, It is. It's amazing how transformative those experiences can be, and then it's not until you do start to reclaim those little aspects of yourself again that you're like, oh my gosh, I forgot that that's who I am. I forgot.
It's funny because it makes us realize, like, you know, funny little things, like maybe towns like Oamaru should come with a warning sign. Like, you know, like in Australia, you've got the fire warning signs, and it's set to low, medium, and high. I like, maybe Oamaru should have a warning sign on either side of town.
My gosh.
Potential narcissist warning.
Do you think it is? Do you think it is Oamaru specific? Because we don't want to diss on one town specifically, or do you think it's like maybe a small town thing? Or is it just a really unfortunate group set of people that...
No, maybe it's just a mindset.
Yes, okay.
Maybe it's a collective mindset that hasn't moved forward or on, that you might get in a lot of small rural towns.
Yeah.
I don't think that people talk about that aspect of small town living enough. I know for sure that I sort of opened up a little bit about what happened to us. I haven't really spoken much about it, but when I did talk about it, honestly, Harriet, I received email after email after email from other women who'd also been in horrific situations, very similar.
Okay.
And it was like
pretty eye-opening.
So this is a bit of an endemic. Like it's not just us.
Okay.
It happens and people are scared to talk about it because it is scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is scary.
That's really interesting, and I'm saddened to hear that that is the case. Yeah. So I've got a couple more topics that we need to cover together because, as I mentioned earlier, you're such an eclectic and interesting woman. So one of your major roles in life is to be mum to your daughter, Frankie, which is – how old is Frankie?
She's 10.
She's
now.
10, amazing, and thriving.
Yeah, she's so cool. She's the coolest little chick. We just love her so much. Mm-mm. She's so happy. Ever since she was a baby, like a tiny baby, she would wake up smiling, which is what I do. And it's so lovely and endearing to see that little quality in her. It's really cool.
She's got the Care Bear quality too. Yeah.
She does. A beautiful thing to
inherit from your mum. So can if you had to tell, if you know, you had to boil it down to one thing, what do you think the greatest thing Frankie or motherhood has taught you is? What do you think?
Patience.
Yeah,
definitely.
That's
for me,
that's one.
I mean, that's the cliche one. What's the word I'm looking for? Maybe selflessness as well.
Yeah.
You know, like Sean and I had spent 20, we had children later on in life. I was 34 when I fell pregnant. I'm now 47 with a 10-year-old. So we, you know, had our own way for so long. And then all of a sudden there's this child and everything centers around your child, including him. This is about me. So that aspect was really heavy to, you know, kind of move into.
I think we don't talk enough. I mean, there's this kind of rose-coloured spectacles view on motherhood that we should all be like, oh, it's all so wonderful and aren't we lucky and we're also grateful for motherhood and all of those things. And absolutely those things are true. But so many women I know definitely go through those feelings of like want of a better word, maybe resentment at times and all of those things for the aspects of yourself that you lose or the time that you lose. And I think it's really healthy that we actually just talk about that stuff. Like it's in part, as you say, learning that selflessness is so profound and so great and so amazing. But at the same time, it does sometimes come with a bit of like, well, that's, you know, look at all the aspects of me that I've given. And is there anything left? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably been like a huge learning curve and something that we're still learning as well. And you're right, I don't think it's spoken about much because, you know, parenting is glamorized and it wasn't that long ago, when was it, like the 1930s and 1940s, where parenting was a propaganda advertisement by the government, like have children, that's just what you need to do,
To be happy and to have a fulfilled life, etc. Yeah.
You know, she's so cool and awesome and we love her so much. One thing I wasn't prepared for with becoming a mum was all of the screaming.
So much screaming.
Even 10 years in. It's insane.
Yes.
This The screaming, especially after we've been traumatized for 5 years and I'm still a little bit on edge, and the screaming is
It sets off like a physical response in your body. Yeah, where your nervous system just, I'm the same. I'm the same if I drop something or if I hear loud noises and stuff. I just immediately go into like that fight or flight response. It's slowly working its way out of my body, but it's fascinating how much the body keeps that information, doesn't it?
Yeah, Sean and I've we've reached a really lovely level with Frankie, and we use boundaries a lot with her to teach her, you know, how to be cool and be nice, and how to be a gentle, awesome human. And these boundaries are really finally starting to pay off for our whole family.
Nice.
Also curbing the screaming and as a parent you have to say no a lot, and that sucks.
It does suck, but it's so nice that you're on the same page with your parenting and you're obviously delivering a really consistent message, because that will pay off ultimately for
The boundaries have been a huge development for us with both Sean, Frankie and I. Our little family unit is it's just really cool. Like,
I think teaching kids boundaries by setting boundaries also teaches them about their ability to set boundaries as well.
Absolutely.
Like, it's really great. Yes.
I think it's so important. I'd love for her to be able to come to me one day and say, "Hey, Mum, I don't really like this," or and that's her showing me her boundaries.
Yep.
And
yep. Absolutely.
And good job.
You've done a good job.
It's constantly learning.
Constantly we're always trying not learning, to learning on the job, and also not to scream back. That's the hardest thing.
I know.
We're just going to have another quick word from our sponsors, the absolute legends at New Zealand Property Solutions.
Looking to make your next property move in Dunedin? Call the team that lives and breathes property. At NZ Property Solutions, we're 100% locally owned, packed with worldwide property experience, bold ideas and serious property market know-how. We're passionate, connected, and yes, we love a good laugh too. Ready for a cracking result? Call the team at NZ Property Solutions today and let's get you moving. 0800 229655.
And a massive big thank you to Denise Casey and her team at NZ Property Solutions. We're so thrilled to have them on board with the Tell Me Moya podcast. Big supporters of all things kind of fun and funky, and they're fabulous. So, I do need to talk to you very, very briefly. Before Frankie came along, you did have a struggle with fertility, and like I understand that the birth was difficult. She was very early. You spent some time in NICU. And then you moved into this sort of volunteer situation where you were photographing families in the neonatal unit. Can you tell us like really quickly a little bit about this? Because we've got it's incredible. It's incredible. So I really want to touch on the thrifting, of course, because that's such massive part of your existence. It would be very remiss not to talk about it. So tell me what inspired you to go back and do the volunteering and the photography. Tell me a little bit about that whole experience.
So that was just actually really random and spur of the moment. I'd always wanted to volunteer my services with my photography at some point. I just never had decided what I was going to do. And yes, we did. It took us 7 years to fall pregnant. It wasn't easy. And then I was diagnosed with a really rare condition called vasa previa, which basically meant that had I ever had a contraction, her blood vessels were exposed. So if I ever had a contraction, it could, immediate death.
Right.
Boom, boom, boom.
God.
So I had to be hospitalised at 30 weeks and was on bed rest for 4.5 weeks.
Which for you, I imagine, was really difficult?
I kind of planned it really perfectly. I photographed a few weddings right up until the day I went into hospital. So when I went into hospital, I had just heaps of editing to do.
Yes, what a genius. Yeah. That's amazing. Right. Yeah.
And I remember I packaged up my last wedding and I walked down to the post office in the hospital. I posted it and I'm going to have my baby now.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, it was pretty sexy. And then she was born 5 weeks early via a planned C-section, and she was in NICU for 3 weeks. And I photographed a lot of newborns throughout my career. And one thing that never occurred to me until it was happening to me was women whose and parents whose babies are in NICU,
yes,
had they had the dream of having newborn photos, that dream is pretty much ripped out from under their feet.
Sure.
You're in NICU, you can't afford it, you don't have time, it's not the place.
No.
So I took heaps of photos of us while we were in NICU, and I'm so glad I did, because it was just such a cool experience. Like, even that, I loved everything about her birth, our experience. It was just so beautiful. So
and
I decided
to have those to look back
out
on too, like to have those now to look back on, so, and have documentation of that time. Yeah. Amazing.
So I reached out to the hospital just randomly. Hey, could I come and volunteer and take photos of the families in NICU? And my emails and my letters fell on deaf ears because it was a heaving organization and they just didn't have time.
Sure.
But I kept pestering and I kept sending emails and I kept, like, you know, hey, it's me again, please, can I do this? Mm-hmm. I really want to help these families. And they've a year later of, you know, pestering, I got a phone call and they said, oh, we love your idea. So I went through a huge induction. And did like a health and safety thing and all this stuff. And yeah, I would just cruise around the NICU ward at the Melbourne Hospital and I would knock on the doors of all of the families and I'd poke my head and I'd be like, hi, my name's Anna. I'm just here to see if you guys want any photos. And initially everybody thought that I was, you know, charging.
Yeah,
and they would say, oh, no.
And
I'm like, no, it's free. It's completely free. I'm here on my own time and I'll send you the gallery. It's free. Most of the times the mum would have a baby on each boob and her boobs would be out and she'd look at me and she'd burst into tears and go, really? I'm like, yes, and we'd both be crying.
Oh, beautiful.
And I'm like, stay there. That's a really nice photo. I've got to get a photo of that. He's got to wipe these tears away.
Just the vulnerability of everyone in that situation. Yeah, beautiful.
It was crazy. I did photograph, you know, some really tragic situations of some families where they were taking babies off life support, so they requested that I come and photograph that moment. And yeah, I did that for 2.5 years, up until
it takes
COVID.
A very, very special person to be able to do that and to strike that balance for families of sort of being there and doing it without being intrusive and holding all that space for them and that tenderness and everything. So that's a real testament to who you are, Anna, that you were able to do that.
I hadn't recalled on that memory for a long time, so thank you for reminding me about it.
Oh, my goodness, what precious, precious, precious thing to do for people.
Yeah.
And, right, of course, like, drum roll, please. Not the main event, but just a massive part of your life and your environment and your world is this thrifting secondhand queen that you are, absolute queen and role model and legend. So you, from what I can gather, pretty much everything that you own, more or less, is thrifted or secondhand or bartered or a gift or exchanged. Yeah.
Or found on the side of the road.
Or found on the side of the road, which is just so amazing and so inspiring, because your house, your environment always is magazine worthy. Like, you obviously have this incredible eye.
Glossy magazines. Like,
yes.
I got that from the rubbish bin.
I love this. Like, I aspire to this so much, but I just don't have the time. I am a pretty, pretty dedicated thrifter. I don't really buy things new. So, yay. It's just that I don't have much stuff because I don't have the time to do it. But you must just have this incredible eye for treasures. Like, when you go into these op shops and there's mountains and mountains of stuff, like, what's your advice to our listeners? Where do you even start?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. Where do we even start? I don't know. I guess you could start with small segments of your house. For instance, maybe you could start with just curtains, and you could find
Right.
out what op shops close to you sell really cool curtains. Just go into the op shops, don't look at anything else, because otherwise, you
You
could be
get
overwhelmed. You
distracted,
could be thinking, oh
yeah.
my gosh, too much stuff in here, and I don't want any of this. So just look at one thing, and if you just think about curtains, go into that op shop, look at the Manchester section, see if they have good curtains. If they don't, walk out, go to the next one. And if you go to maybe five or six op shops and you just find out what of those sell good curtains, and you'll find that there'll be two or three op shops that have a consistently good selection of curtains, then that's the op shops that you want to go to over the next few weeks, because they're always bringing in new
Yeah, new
stuff.
stock. Yeah.
Just look at the curtains. I love curtains, and they're so expensive to buy new.
Yeah.
Buying them new, you can spend $200 or $300 on a new set of curtains, and they're still going to look like they've come out of a 1986 office conference room.
Yeah,
But
yes.
you go to an op shop and you spend time just going in every other day and seeing if there's any new curtains in this op shop that you know have good curtains. You will find good curtains. Put them in
Yeah.
of your windows and your phone so that you know what
Yes,
sizes
good
you
tip,
need.
good tip.
And yeah, just concentrate on one thing at a time. That's pretty much what I've done. It's taken decades. It's not, it's that Pantene ad. It won't happen overnight.
Yeah, but then you've had to move and like restart again and stuff. So a lot of that system is great because it's so much more affordable, right? Like rebuilding a home and redecorating a home or a space
Yeah, I wouldn't
or an
recommend
up.
moving as
Yeah,
much as
sure. No,
we
fair enough.
are.
That's a good shout. Yeah.
We're not proud
But this is what I love about you. One of the things I love about you, it's like when we think about op shopping, when your average person thinks about op shopping, we think about clothes or maybe the odd knick-knack or maybe a bit of furniture or something. But for you, it's like it's for life. It's like stationery, it's towels, it's bedding, it's
Totally.
curtains, it's kitchenware, tools, all of the things. And I genuinely believe
100%.
that there's enough stuff in the world right now. Like if we stopped making anything, we'd have enough stuff for quite a long time, wouldn't we, in the world?
It was quite funny, but absolutely. I actually didn't understand my own op shop philosophy or how I managed to use the op shops the way that I do. It never made any sense to me. I just did it. And it wasn't until recently Sean sat me down and he said, I need to tell you, because the way that you use op shops is so unique and so different and so beautiful. I don't actually think you even realize what you're doing.
Nice.
And so we came up with what we've called Anna's op shop philosophy. And
Yay,
it's
let's hear
basically
it.
to I become one with my op shops. So I'm not just using my op shops to buy clothes or go in and find a piece of treasure. I find out what each and every single one of my op shops specializes in. Some might specialize in a tool section. Some might specialize in
Yeah.
curtains. Some might specialize in bed sheets. Some
Yeah.
might have a really awesome furniture selection. And I really become one with every single one of those op shops, and I find out what one has what. So when I'm sitting at home and I'm maybe hanging up some artwork, and I'm thinking, oh, I need a new hammer, I don't go to a big department store. I go to the op shop that I know has the hammers.
Yeah, you really
And it,
familiarize yourself with the op
yeah.
shops. Yeah, like you become one with them. Yeah.
Get to know your op shops like you would an old friend. Know them really, really well and intimately, and walk the aisles like a creep. Find out their hours, figure out where the best place to get a car park is, figure out where the best place, where the next best op shop is if there is no car park in front of the one that you're going to.
Yeah. Yes, amazing, amazing advice. And because we would all benefit from doing this a little bit more, wouldn't we? Like the world would benefit, everyone, everything would benefit.
The other cool thing about the Chop says, I mean, you know, like, yes. So I keep a list on our whiteboard of all of the little things that I might need over the week. So we need a new hammer. I need a new cheese grater. Frankie needs new bed sheets. King single, write the size down. So I've got this like little knick-knack list on the side of my whiteboard that it's just, I've gotten good. It used to be in my head, but I can't live in there anymore because there's too many wires in there at the moment.
Too much other stuff. Yeah, yeah, totally.
And so when, like, you know, if there's a time that I have an hour or so, then I know that I can go to all these op shops with this list of things that most people would maybe need to go to the mall and go to seven different shops for, but I can use the op shop instead.
So good. And it is good. Just before we do have to disappear in just a moment, but just before you left Dunedin, I know that you were running a couple of workshops about sustainability and about thrifting specifically, was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So is there any way we can get hold of these or any chance you'll do them again, do more of them?
I've been in talks with a couple of other councils about potentially doing more, which is really exciting.
Awesome.
They don't exist anywhere online at the moment. It's all in my head. Sorry.
good. That's a precious place to keep them. Yeah.
But it's nice to get this information out and try and teach people how to use op shops the way that I have, because I do think it's quite unique. And I, you know, like, you can go into an op shop and get the potato peeler and the hammer and the pair of sheets that you need, and you can leave with a $2 disco ball, and you would have had a good old chat to one of the volunteers there. I bet you don't get that at many of the big department stores.
It's honestly, it's so good. It's just such a fascinating aspect of your life, and I just love that. I love that about you. I totally want to be you when I grow up in terms of thrifting. So that's, you are my role model. Anna, it has been so lovely to have you this morning. You've been listening to Anna Easton in conversation with Harriet Moyer on Tell Me Moyer. For more information about Anna, you can go to www.shehuntsopshops.com, or you can follow She Hunts Op Shops on Facebook or Instagram. And just to remember the name of the book that may or may not ever be published, it's called So You Want to Start a Poo Business. So You Want to Own a Poo Business. So You Want to Buy a Poo Business. So You Want to Buy a Poo Business. So one day in the future, if you're browsing the shelves at the local bookshop, you might come across it and want to buy it. For more information about my shows and shenanigans, you can follow me on Instagram or Facebook, Harriet Moyer Entertainer MC.
Oh, thank you so much for having
thank
me,
thank you for being with me today. Thank you so much, Anna.
Okay.
You've been listening to Tell Me Moyer, where the conversations with women are brave, bold, and occasionally make you clutch your pearls in a good way. Heard something that made you gasp, giggle, or immediately text your group chat? Don't worry, we've got you. You can replay this episode or dive into more colourful conversations at oar.org.nz or find us on your favourite podcast platform. For more information about my shows and shenanigans, follow me on Instagram and Facebook, Harriet Moyer Entertainer MC. Thanks so much to Denise Casey and the legends at New Zealand Property Solutions for their tremendous support. Now, go on, hit subscribe. You know you want to.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.